Welcome. My name is Mimi Lewis. I'm a student at Yeshivat Hadar for the year, and I'll be introducing Rabbi Held. Rabbi Shai Held is one of the Roshei HaYeshiva at Yeshivat Hadar and also one of the co-founders of Mechon Hadar. Here at Hadar, he's the chair of Jewish thought and teaches a lot of classes during the summer and the year. One of my favorite parts of having Rabbi Held, or Rav Shai as he's known here, as a teacher is he has this amazing talent for turning even the most simple question into actually a very profound statement. So I just want to encourage all of you to ask questions of him after his session tonight, because I promise you he'll make you feel even smarter afterwards. Tonight, Shai is going to be teaching on faith, doubt, and the possibility of believing in our time. So, Rabbi Held.
So here's the thing. You really want the compliment of knowing how to take complicated ideas and making them accessible, as opposed to taking accessible ideas and making them complicated. But that's fine. If I knew I could do that, I would have tried to get tenure somewhere. Okay. So let me say just a couple of words about what I want to try to accomplish tonight. I want to talk not so much about why we should believe or have faith, but rather about what it might mean or look like to do so. And then the question and answers can lead where they will. Now, just to give you a sense of an outline of where we're headed, I'm going to start by saying just a few words about what the word emunah, which we'll translate for now as a working definition as faith, means in the Bible and the rabbis, in Chazal. Then I want to spend some time talking about how the Rambam transforms the meaning of that term and the repercussions and reverberations of that to the present day. Then I'll say a few things about faith and doubt and about the ways in which doubt can be seen as a constitutive piece of faith rather than a threat to it. And then we'll see if we have any time. And if we do, I'll talk a little bit about what a life of faith could look like. Okay, so that's a bit of a tall order, but we're going to try to do it. So first, a few historical comments. For the Torah, the primary meaning of emunah is trust. When the Torah uses the word emunah, it usually means trust, or in the language of 20th century philosophy, it means belief in rather than belief that. Belief in, right, is a term of relationship. Belief that is a term of cognition. I believe a certain claim about the world. Belief in other words, is something that happens between people, you could say. We'll complicate that in a minute. Belief that is something that happens between a person and an idea. So in the Bible, emunah is belief in and not belief that. Or to use my terms, faith in the Bible is not cognitive but existential. It's not the belief in a series of statements, but rather a kind of posture towards God and the world. And more importantly, and I'll come back to this, it's about the total person turning to God rather than the mind cognizing God. It's about the total person entering into relation. Now, just to be clear for a second, lest I draw these lines in too stark a way, belief in, on some level, you could say, presupposes some version of belief that. Right? In order to enter into a relationship with God, I must at least on some inchoate level have a belief about that God exists, or that something corresponds to the term God. Unless I'm a wrong-headed contemporary Wittgensteinian, but that's another story. That was just for those who want me to get tenure in philosophy. Now, belief that, here's the interesting thing about the Bible, belief that was taken for granted by the Bible. Meaning, I can see no text in the Bible which considers the question, is there a God? Is there a God in whom I'm disappointed is a question that comes up a lot. But is there a God? A belief that question is not a question in the Bible. It's one that is taken for granted. The question of faith, in other words, is not, do you believe that there is a God? But do you place your trust? Do you commit yourself to a relationship with this God? Maybe I'll say this one more way. For the Bible, the opposite of emunah, the opposite of faith, is not, as it will become later, kfira, heresy. It is rather lack of trust, or, as I'll explain in a minute, because I think this will become very interesting, lack of trustworthiness. The opposite of emunah is lack of trust, lack of trustworthiness. It is not heresy. Now, on the sheets in front of you, you have a few examples of emunah as trust. And in the interest of time, I won't really go through them other than to point your attention to Exodus 14, which is the third source. Vayaminu b'Hashem uv'Moshe avdo. And the Israelites came to believe in God and in Moses, his servant, right? That is clearly not a description of they came to cognize God, they came to have some kind of belief that there is a God, but rather they came to place their trust in God. And although this in itself is an interesting discussion, one of the most famous psukim about emunah, one of the most famous verses of emunah, is the last one on this page, when Abraham decides, or Abraham has faith in God, ve'amin ba'ashem v'yachsheve alot tzedakah. Abraham believed in God, and probably what this means is God accounted it to his righteousness. That is, again, Abraham chose to believe God's promises, to trust that God's word was reliable. That's the dominant meaning of trust in the Bible. Now, one of the things that I find kind of interesting is the word emunah in the Tanakh, it sort of migrates a little to include some of what comes along with trust, and that is trustworthiness, faithfulness, and eventually even integrity and uprightness. So you might, in modern Hebrew, translate emunah as it appears in certain parts of the Tanakh as yosher. It's uprightness. It's upstandingness. So if you turn to the second page, you have a couple of examples. The most, I think, dramatic formulation of this is in the book of Deuteronomy, Sefer Dvarim, 32:4. Hatzur tamim po'alo ki chol drachav mishpat, el emunah ve'ein avel, tzadik v'yasharhu. Now, biblical parallelism, el emunah ve'ein avel, a God of emunah, and without iniquity. In other words, emunah there means ein avel, a God who can be trusted because there is something about God that is trustworthy. Yirmiyahu uses this term this way, about the person who goes looking for a person who has emunah, which does not mean a person of faith, but a person who actually is worthy of trust. The most sort of accessible example of this is if you think about the two psalms that end in virtually the same way in the Kabbalat Shabbat service, Psalm 96 and Psalm 98. Psalm 96 ends, Lifnei Hashem kivam, on the fourth verse that I quoted here, Lifnei Hashem kiva lishpot ha'aretz, yishpot tevel b'tzedek, God will judge the world with righteousness, ve'amim be'emunato, and peoples with his emunah. And then the parallel verse, Lifnei Hashem kivah lishpot ha'aretz, yishpot tevel b'tzedek ve'amim b'meisharim. God will judge the nations with equity, with justice. So the biblical parallel for emunah here is meisharim, uprightness. Now, I want to suggest something about this that I don't think is just a drasha, but if it is, so be it, right? And that is that the Bible here makes an assumption that may not be obvious to us, which is that authentic faith presumes faithfulness And authentic trust presumes trustworthiness. You cannot pretend to trust God if you yourself are a person lacking in integrity. Real trust requires trustworthiness. It's a fundamentally relational category, which means you are responsible in the same way that you imagine the other to be responsible to you. In other words, emunah, I'm suggesting, in the Bible, is not something I have, or not primarily something I have, but much more fundamentally, something that I am. Emunah is not something that I have, it's something that I am. It's a description of who I am as a human being. I have entered into a relationship of trust and trustworthiness, where I have expectations, and those expectations also exist for me. Now, I think it's fair to say that for the rabbis of the Talmud, for the sages, the word emunah is totally consistent in the use of the rabbis to its use in the Bible. And I just gave you two very quick examples here. These are two of the most well-known sort of short, agadic, midrashic statements of the rabbis. And you see here two ostensibly different, but I'm insisting connected, meanings of the word. So first, in Masechet Sotah, Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol Omer, I'm at the bottom of page 2, Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol Omer, Kol mi sheyesh lo pat besilo ve'omer ma'ochal le'machar eino ela miktanei amana. Rabbi Eliezer the Great declares, whoever has a piece of bread in his basket and says, what shall I eat tomorrow, belongs to those who are of little faith. That in itself we could spend lots of time talking about. That is the meaning of emunah. That is the meaning of emunah that is perhaps maybe more familiar, trust. But then, turn for a second to another passage that is worth spending a lot of time on that we won't. This is an often quoted rabbinic text about faith. I'm sorry, about what happens after death. And here's the line. B'sha'a shemachnisin adam ledin omrim lo. The first question one is asked when one dies is, nasata v'natata be'emunah. Did you do business with integrity? In other words, not did you trust, but were you trustworthy? By the way, for those who are interested in this, I can't find a source for this, but there's a kind of almost like folk interpretation of this passage that theologians like, where they read nasata v'natata be'emunah as, did you spend your time really thinking about faith? That's not what this Gemara means, okay? Just to be clear, right? Nasata v'natata be'emunah means, did you act faithfully? So once again, just from two examples in the rabbis, you have this marriage of faith and faithfulness, trust and trustworthiness, sort of gravitating to the point of integrity, uprightness, steadfastness. Now, it's probably worth noting that Martin Buber famously suggested that the fundamental difference between biblical theology or biblical God-human relationship and Hellenistic Pauline Christianity is that he believed that the Bible was interested in belief in, whereas Hellenistic Christianity was interested in belief that. That was what he said was the difference between emunah and pistis. Emunah is a question of relationality and trust. Pistis is what are the cognitive assertions I'm willing to make. He also, if you know something about Buber, you know that he was something of a fan of Jesus as a Jew, was very insistent that the circle around Jesus had a sense of faith that was very much continuous with the Hebrew Bible, and that it's really Paul, the bogeyman for a certain generation of modern Jewish thinkers about Christianity. It was Paul who sort of led Christianity astray into this radical Hellenization, where faith was really about a bunch of things you were willing to say, yes, I believe assertion X is true. Okay. Many contemporary Christian theologians think that Buber is oversimplifying, to say the least, but it's a very influential view. And it's probably the most famous place where this distinction of belief in and belief that gets play in 20th century thought. Okay, so now What I'd like to talk about, and I want to do this respectfully but also unabashedly critically, is how the Rambam, Maimonides, transforms the category of emunah. If the Torah and the Talmud see faith in terms of loyalty, faithfulness to God, Rambam completely transforms it to a category of knowledge. Faith is a knowledge category. Now, to be sure, he thinks that a person who has knowledge of God also will likely have a deep emotional attachment to God, which, if you read the end of the guide or the 10th chapter of Hilchot Teshuvah, you discover that Rambam has very deep passion about God. But nevertheless, the key to faith is to know something cognitively. Or again, to return to these categories, for the Rambam, emunah becomes unequivocally a form of belief that, not a form of belief in. It is about truths that I cognize. Now, I just want to take a minute to note the sort of breathtaking historical irony here. That is, that the person whose definitions of faith came to define orthodoxy, small o, and eventually capital O, was himself, in doing so, radically transforming and introducing a notion of faith that was entirely without precedent in Jewish thought, with the possible exception of Saadia Gaon, but who's also medieval and recent to Maimonides, post-Talmudic. That is, that the creation of orthodoxy, small o again, emerges from a move that is entirely unorthodox. Right? The Rambam transforms what faith means, and that becomes, to some extent, to a large extent, the dominant definition of what faith is. Of course, there's also an irony in orthodoxy coming to be defined by a figure who spends his life, as we talked about a little bit last time, not to mention his afterlife, accused of heresy, lack of orthodoxy, and not without some plausible cause. Now, if you look for a minute at part three on your sheet, the first thing that's there is just to potentially refresh your mind, a summary of what the 13 principles are. But what I really want to spend a moment on is just to show you how radical the Rambam is here and how utterly subversive of everything that came before. I am reading one paragraph that is the very end, at the end of Maimonides listing what he considers to be the 13 principles of faith. This is what he writes. After he's finished the list, this is what he writes. And we're going to read this quickly and then go back and, as it were, unpack a few of these sentences. When all these foundations are perfectly understood, by the way, the reason you only have this in English is that this text is in Arabic. Okay? When all these foundations are perfectly understood and believed in by a person, he enters the community of Israel, and one is obligated to love and pity him and to act towards him in all the ways in which the Creator has commanded that one should act towards his brother with love and fraternity. Even were he to commit every possible transgression because of lust and because of being overpowered by the evil inclination, he will be punished according to his rebelliousness. But he has a portion of the world to come. He is one of the sinners of Israel. But if a man doubts any of these foundations, he leaves the community of Israel, denies the fundamental, and is called an Epicurus, one who is kotsets banetiyot, cuts among the plantings. One is required, this is not exactly, you know, language that is appealing to a modern pluralistic mindset, one is required to hate him and destroy him. About such a person it was said, "Do I not hate them, O Lord, who hate thee?" Now, if you're reading closely, there's something here that the Rambam just said that is breathtaking. That is, that a person who believes these things is in all the ways that ultimately matter a Jew. And a person who does not is not a Jew. This is an amazing claim, right? If you believe these things, you are already in some crucial way. There are still halakhic technicalities to deal with, but you're Jewish. And if you, by the way, not just deny these things, but doubt them, then you are not Jewish. Now, let's back up for a second. And here I want to borrow a thought from Menachem Kellner, who spent a lot of time working on these principles. Last time, I pointed out that Rambam was ferociously opposed to what I called ontological essentialism. That is, to the view that Jews are somehow ontologically distinct, that it's hardware, in the language of Danny Lasker, it's hardware that separates Jews from Gentiles. And instead, he insisted that it's software. It's what Jews think and know. But here, he has replaced the definition of a Jew, according to which it is something that is biological or ontological, and replaced it, amazingly, with a category of knowledge, right? Jewishness is defined by affirming a list of cognitive claims. I was talking to one of my colleagues the other day who said, this is totally fascinating, except it's not Judaism, right? I mean, it's an astonishing claim that the Rambam makes. Now, note, not in order to be a Jew in good standing, or to be anachronistic, to be an Orthodox Jew, but to be a Jew at all. I don't have time to develop this at length, but it's hard to overstate how extreme the Rambam's position here is. First of all, doubt is entirely impermissible. There is, in the language of halakha, no such thing as kfirah bishgaga, right? There's no such thing as being wrong in a good faith way. You're still a heretic, not a Jew, and don't have a share in the world to come. In other words, if you don't believe the right things, you're out, not Jewish. Or maybe the Rambam might say, you're Jewish on a halachic technicality, but you're in fact, in the ways that matter, not a Jew. Even more, again, if you read this passage again, belief in the 13 principles of faith is not only necessary to achieve a life in the world to come, and what that means for the Rambam is its own interesting discussion, but it is also sufficient. It's not only necessary, but it's sufficient. Not how many mitzvot I do, not how much moral virtue I cultivate, but my affirmation of these doctrinal claims is my ticket to eternity. Now, just to be fair, for the Rambam, intellectual virtue, moral virtue is a prerequisite for intellectual virtue. This is an interesting claim, right? You cannot ultimately arrive at true knowledge without also being a particular kind of human being. But that is a means and not an end. What matters, what determines your Jewishness, and more dramatically, what determines your stake in eternity is whether or not you affirm this list of beliefs. Now, even more stunningly, all of this is rooted in a commitment to an Aristotelian conception of what a human being is, that each of us is born a human being in potential, and based on the metaphysical truths we come to know, we become fully human. Now, I'm not going to sort of flesh out the implications of that in all their disturbingness, but it's quite a dramatic claim. Now, it's important to note how much disagreement there was with Rambam, both in terms of the project of articulating dogmas and in terms of the actual list he chose. But even more importantly, and from the Rambam's perspective, quite tragically, his list was mainly treated as a list of the foundational beliefs of Judaism. Almost no one bought into the theology and anthropology that underlies the Rambam's making of this list in the first place, that is, that I have to know these things in order to be human, Jewish, and having a share in the world to come. And I'm definitely not aware, Eugene, you can tell me if you think I'm wrong here, of any source after Maimonides ever that took seriously the claim that Jewishness is defined by a set of cognitive assents. It actually took a few hundred years for anyone to realize what Rambam had said here. Abarbanel comes along and says, if anyone didn't notice, this paragraph is defining what it means to be Yisrael, what it means to be a Jew. So people either didn't notice or chose to ignore some of the most dramatic pieces of the Rambam. Now, here's where I want to push this point. For Maimonides, It is not enough to believe these claims, at least the first few. One also has to know them. That is, one has to demonstrate them to oneself as true. Thus, in other words, let's just put this sort of flat out. If you want to be an Orthodox Jew, according to Rambam, you also must be an expert in Aristotelian logic and metaphysics. Otherwise, you do not know that there is a God, and you are as good as not Jewish. Now, of course, as a rabbi and a halachist, he's not going to say this quite as flat out when he talks in Hilchot Isurei Biyah about what it means to convert and become Jewish, but the implication is there dramatically for all to see. Now, I'll ask a question that I hope is self-explanatorily rhetorical. How many contemporary Jewish figures who use the list of the 13 principles as a criterion by which to define authentic Jewish belief or to root out heretics would actually pass the Rambam's test? How many 7th grade Talmud teachers who make kids feel like they're heretics for asking questions would get into the Rambam's heaven? The answer is perilously close to zero. I'm saying perilously close because I had 7th grade teachers who I liked, and I don't want to cast aspersions upon them. But the claim is astonishing. Now think about this for a second. So the Rambam's list of 13 principles, understood in an incredibly simplistic way, become the criterion for orthodoxy, again, small o, for many people. And yet the irony is that those who are most invested in that list completely fail on its own terms. And just to make this clear, to allude to something I talked about last time, the Rambam says explicitly, this is in, I think it's chapter 50 of the first part of the guide, the Rambam says that anyone who says that God has any attributes at all is an idolater. Right? God is, in the language of philosophy, which we won't get into, absolutely simple. Now, I wish good luck to the thought police of the modern Jewish people in passing the Rambam's test. Meaning, like, if the Rambam's right, he and three of his friends are hanging out and enjoying it all themselves. Right? I mean, it's really an amazing thing to think about what he's just said and how there's this double paradox, right? On the one hand, the move that becomes defined as orthodoxy, small o, is itself radically unorthodox, and those who use it to define orthodoxy fundamentally misunderstand what he means by it and would most likely fail. Now, more fundamentally still, and this is in a way a transition that I want to suggest, in an age where the enormous majority of philosophers believe that God's existence is not provable, I'll return to this in a little while, but we live after Kant, is it actually conceivably possible that anyone passes the first dogma, which is to know that there is a God? In other words, by definition, to live after Kant is to be, in the Rambam system, less than human, not Jewish, and having no share in eternity. Because after all, I don't know that the first claim is true. Now, let me just be clear about one thing. I am not saying anything at all about whether I think Judaism should have dogmas, let alone what I think they should be. I'm only pointing out, first, that Rambam's conception of faith as belief that is a dramatic deviation from everything that came before him. Second, that it's rooted in a conception of Jewishness, and for that matter, humanness, that I hope we would all reject. I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. Third, that it makes demands that assume the truth of medieval conceptions of logic and metaphysics, and that these are obviously outdated and untenable in our own time. Fourth, that it assumes that certain fundamental truths are demonstrable, which, with the exception of some contemporary Christian philosophers of religion, most of us agree is in fact no longer possible. That is to say, this list is problematic on its own terms, all the more so in modernity. Now, pushing forward for 1 minute, and then maybe I'll come back to this question of what is a self. One additional point of taking this list seriously and out of context. Let's talk for a minute about the seventh and eighth principles about revelation. Right? The ultimate bludgeons by which heresy and faith are defined in the modern period. Abraham Joshua Heschel spent hundreds of pages in his study of rabbinic theology pointing to the enormous range of perspectives held by the rabbis about what it meant to say that the Torah was somehow derived from God. And in his own works of theology, he posited a very sharp distinction between divine revelation on the one hand and Mosaic authorship on the other, right? Insisting that one was a matter of faith and the other was a matter for historians. And just as, and by the way, this is a double-edged claim, which I think is very important for understanding what this modern thinker is doing, that means that a believer cannot come to a historian and say you're wrong about a historical claim because a historical claim, Mosaic authorship, is dogma. But it also means that a historian can't presume to answer the question of whether and in what way God is involved in the creation of this document, because that, too, is a category mistake. No historian can ever answer the question of what role God has in the unfolding of anything, right? That's a fundamental misunderstanding of what a historian can and can't do. Now, one of the things Heschel was trying to do was open a space for an array of views in modern Judaism about what it means to say yes on the question of revelation. Or, I'll say what I think Heschel is thinking. How much damage has been done to the possibility of belief and affirmation in our time by the insistence that the fundamental question to ask about revelation is simply yes or no? And often that's asked in incredibly crude forms, right? Do you believe that God wrote a book and gave it to Moses? How many people have been told, if you don't believe this, you're essentially a heretic. You don't believe in revelation. And have been led to conclude that they must not, after all, be believers. Now, the reason why this is ironic, again, is because the way that most thinkers who affirm that dogma imagine revelation, for the Rambam, is not just wrong, but actually idolatry. Because if you imagine, I'll be simplistic and even a little mean. If you imagine like a big guy writing some stuff on tablets, well, as we talked about at length last time, the fact that you believe in the first half of that sentence is already idolatry. And the second is so crudely anthropomorphic that I don't even know the Rambam says what you're talking about. So to use the Rambam's insistence on divine authorship of the Torah as a bludgeon is actually, again, an ironic and totally unself-aware use of his theology. Now, why am I saying all this? Because I think in many ways, traditional Judaism, has been damaged in unspeakable ways by the fear of many rabbis and thinkers that anyone say anything that engages with, and I'm only using this as an example, let's say academic scholarship on the Bible. One who does that is basically a heretic. There are very prominent yeshivot that are held up as intellectually open yeshivot, where if you so much as take a course in academic Bible at the Hebrew University, you must leave, right? And Heschel's point, and you may not be surprised to know that I'm totally sympathetic to this, is that's, in addition to being crazy, also historically wrong. It's a bad reading of the Talmud, and it's actually, ironically, a bad reading of the Rambam, who must have had a much more complex conception of what it means to say that the Torah is divine, given his conception of God. Now, I want to use the Rambam himself for a minute to make a point which will ensure that I never serve on the faculty of various institutions in this city. Recall what the Rambam himself says in the guide. Rambam says an astonishing thing. If someone could demonstrate to me, he says, that Aristotle is right about the age of the world, then I will have no choice but to admit that Aristotle is right, that the world is eternal, and to interpret Genesis 1 accordingly. Right? If you can show me that the world is eternal, I will find a way to read Bereshit Perek Aleph as talking about the eternity of the world. So would Rambam really have forbidden people to engage with 400 years of scholarship? Or would he have been open to the possibility that, at least for the sophisticated, theology might have to be adjusted based on the development of modern knowledge? Now, again, I'm not actually arguing here for or against biblical criticism, let alone any school therein. I'm only pointing out how dangerous and damaging it is when dogma becomes dogmatism and heresy hunting. And the real point I want to make, the bottom line point about all this, we all know that creating a list of dogma is damaging to those who fall outside it, but the point I want to make is that it's insidious and damaging to those who fall inside it as well, because they find themselves not permitted to think. Because after all, this is not, by the way, not a good reading of the Rambam, as I've emphasized, but they find themselves essentially being told, sign here or not, never mind that the list was made 800 years ago. I myself endured many such experiences, so it's not like a theoretical issue. Now, in the end, put very crudely, dogma means, let me put this differently, unmoving dogma means that theology is frozen for all times. I'm going to give you an example for a second. David Ferguson, who's a contemporary Scottish Christian theologian, recently wrote the following thing. Theology requires restatement, revision, and adjustment. Theology is never immobile. To assume that theology reached its zenith in the 4th, 13th, or 17th centuries, as Orthodox, Roman Catholic, and Protestant Christians have sometimes been tempted to do, is merely to ignore the problems of modernity and the seriousness with which these need to be tackled. Making appropriate adjustments, we can say, Jewish theology cannot possibly have been frozen for all time in 12th century Spain. And the point is, and this is really an astonishing thing to think about, right? The champion of, the greatest champion in the history of Judaism, of the enterprise of philosophy, has been used in such a way that makes philosophy impermissible and impossible in traditional Jewish settings. So the Rambam has actually ended up causing precisely what I think deep down he most valued. The Rambam was the person who said, philosophizing is a mitzvah. And yet the Rambam has been used to create a culture where one lives in terror of actually engaging in philosophy in its modern idiom. Now, I want to just come back, before we leave the Rambam, to this question of what is a self. In a very recent essay, Menachem Kellner suggests something that I had never thought of, but I think is quite striking. He says, the reason why, for Maimonides, belief in is so much less important and so much lower than belief that, is that belief in is merely existential, whereas belief that is intellectual. And after all, what it means to really become a human being in the world of medieval philosophizing is to become a realized intellect, an intellect in actu, in the language of medieval philosophy. Now, I hope, you know, whenever I say hope, it goes without saying. It's actually not true because I'm going to say it, but I hope it would go without saying, right, that we would want to reverse this formula completely and say, actually, no, adaraba, on the contrary, belief that is lower than belief in is on some level less significant because it is merely existential, is merely intellectual and not existential. That is, it posits, it operates on a conception of the human being who is fundamentally a mind, as opposed to a conception of a human being who is a person. And so we have this paradoxical opportunity to be more orthodox than Maimonides by returning to the conception of faith that governs the Bible and rabbinic literature. We have the opportunity to be more continuous with how emunah is understood in Tanakh and Chazal than the medieval philosophers were. Now, Okay, I'll leave that. Let me say a few words about faith itself. The way that I often think about faith, and forgive the somewhat pretentious formulation of this, is that faith is fundamentally an existential posture. That is, it's a life orientation. Or, in Martin Buber's language, it's a Haltung, a way of holding oneself, a way one presents the way one holds oneself in relationship and presents oneself in the face of another. So how is faith different than holding a theoretical or propositional belief? First of all, just to repeat a point I made at the beginning, belief that is about a proposition. Belief in is actually about a person, or, to go back to language I ended with last time, about something or someone that can be related to in personal terms. Right? You don't have belief in an idea, you have belief in someone. And at least theoretically, belief that can be held fairly indifferently, without emotion, without affect. Whereas belief in has to be effective, emotional, passionate. Or to say this in as modest a way as possible, belief in is characterized by passion and commitment in a way that a theoretical belief is not necessarily, right? The Rambam held theoretical beliefs with profound passion. But you can, in theory, hold a belief that without your whole personality being invested in it. Now, for me, one of the most helpful ways for thinking about what faith is or what it could be is thinking about it through the lens of what doubt is. Many of us have been raised to instinctively fear doubt, or we were taught that doubt could only ruin faith and lead down the path to all kinds of destructive things, what we used to call going off the derech, right? Now, but I want to suggest, actually, that the opposite is the case, that some doubt is not only tolerable, but a prerequisite for authentic faith. Some doubt is a prerequisite for authentic faith. In order to do that, I want to ask you to turn with me for a second to one of the most famous sugyot, famous pieces of Talmud. This is, and I hope to read it in a slightly, I hope, semi-non-standard way. Okay? So Shabbat 88a, interpreting the famous verse, Vayityatzu b'tachti tahar, the Jewish people stood at the foot of the mountain. Amar Rav Abdimi Bar Chama Bar Chasa, this means Milamed Shekafa Kadosh Baruch Hu Aleihem Et Ahar Kegigit Ve'amar Lahem Im Atem Mekablim HaTorah Mutav Ve'im Lav Sham Tehei Kivuratchem. God holds Mount Sinai over their head. This is based on a pun of Tachtit, literally meaning underneath, right? God holds the mountain over their head and says, if you accept the Torah, great, and if not, this will be the place where you die. Great. Except the next line, I think, is one of the most audacious in rabbinic literature, and it creates the possibility in many ways of a mature Jewish theology. Amar Rabbi Acha bar Yaakov, Mikan Moda'a Rabba Le'oraita. From here, we have a great protest against the Torah. What's the great protest? Rashi says, it is a contract under duress, and everybody knows that a contract under duress is not binding. If it is true that the mountain was held over the head of the Jewish people at Mount Sinai, there is no covenant. It is a contract under duress. Implicit in that, of course, is a certain degree of human dignity before God, that human agency matters even, and over time, perhaps especially, in the face of God. And then comes the answer, Amar Rava, Afal Pichein, Hadur Kiblu Abimei Achashverosh. They accepted it again in the days of Achashverosh, Dichtiv, as it is said, and then comes this somewhat stretch reading of a verse, Kimu v'kiblu ayudim, the Jews accepted upon themselves these days of celebration, are read to mean they accepted at Purim what they had originally accepted at Sinai. So, okay, just to sort of unravel this for a second, I would suggest that the mountain that God holds over their head is a world of immediate and transparent reward and punishment. In other words, a world in which I know that when I sin, I will be punished, and when I do good, I will be rewarded, is a world in which, most likely, I can never actually be good, and I can certainly never know that I'm good. Because, as Barbara Spector recently put it, a world in which God threatens me and I choose to do the good is a world in which I am not good, but only self-evidently not stupid. Right? No, that's the problem. Because all faith becomes self-interest, self-protection. In other words, now let's imagine this relationally for a minute. If I hold a gun to your head and say, love me, and you begin to be incredibly kind and generous and sweet to me, I don't know anything about your existential posture towards me. I only know that you'd rather not be killed. What the rabbis are saying here in their characteristically sort of terse, elusive, elusive way, right, is actually that the world of Har Kegigit is a world in which God can never know that I'm good, and I can never know that I'm good, and more fundamentally, there can never be actual relationality, relationship between me and God. So in other words, for the covenant to mature as a true relationship, that is, for it to be rooted in love rather than abject fear, yirat ha'onesh, that is, fear of punishment, divine intervention in general, and reward and punishment in particular, need to be subtle and maybe even hidden altogether. That's why Purim is so central to the rabbis. A world in which God's presence is hidden, subtle, requires the acquisition of the art of discernment. That is, one has to detect the presence of God rather than be bludgeoned with it. So there's a strange paradox here that I think lies at the heart of this piece of Gemara, that in order to have a relationship with God in which I am free, or in order to serve God, rather than my instinct for self-preservation, God must, to some extent, be hidden. In order for me to have a relationship with God that is mature, God on some level must be hidden. Faith, in other words, is at least partly about learning to see what is not obvious to the eye. Now, one of the most influential lines in all of philosophy, paragraphs in all of philosophy of religion and theology, is a paragraph from Kierkegaard's Concluding Unscientific Postscript, which I don't really have the time to go into at any length, but I just want to read a couple of sentences, and we'll see how the category of faith is transformed. A definition of truth, Kierkegaard writes, an objective uncertainty held fast in an appropriation process of the most passion inwardness is the truth, the highest truth attainable for an existing individual. Now, like every sentence in Kierkegaard, one could spend many hours trying to unpack what he's doing here. But one of the things he's saying is, I think, world-altering, and that is, faith is not only not threatened by doubt, faith actually requires doubt. Because if I know something, I can't have faith in it, because I know it. Faith is the decision to cast my lot with something about which I am objectively uncertain. Now, I wish we had the time to read this at length, but let's read the last sentence. This is an amazing line often quoted in philosophy. If I wish to preserve myself in faith, I must constantly be intent upon holding fast the objective uncertainty. If I actually want to be a believer, I actually have to be committed to not knowing. Kierkegaard might say, take that, the whole medieval philosophical tradition, right? So as to remain out upon the deep, over 70,000 fathoms of water, still preserving my faith. In other words, there is no faith without risk. There is no faith without risk. Faith is the decision to commit to something precisely when I don't know it to be true. In other words, to say this in the language of philosophy, you may not realize it, but what Kant did for faith was save it. Because the fact that I cannot know that there is a God is actually what makes faith possible. And here I'll suggest, between Kant on the one hand, and the fact that it seems fair to say that we don't live in a world that is anything like filled with manifest divine reward and punishment, modernity in certain ways is a unique opportunity for mature faith. Modernity is a unique opportunity for mature faith precisely because I cannot know. All I can do is decide to commit myself. And the language in Kierkegaard, if you read him closely, which is extremely important, is I do it with passion. This is not about sitting in a room thinking, there might be, there might not be, I think there is. Right? That's not it. That is what Kierkegaard, in his inimitable style, would say. That's what assistant professors do. He loves to sort of talk. Those are the people who are just wrong-headed about everything, assistant professors. But a person of faith is one who risks absolutely everything. Now, without doubt, in other words, no faith. Some people take Kierkegaard to mean that I should believe something because of its absurdity. And there are moments in Kierkegaard where he seems to say something like that. I just want to say, I don't think that's at all what Kierkegaard means. But in any case, it shouldn't be what we mean. In other words, I don't think we should be against arguments for or against religious belief, but we should be against the fantasy that we can achieve full certainty. And I'm also suggesting that that may be a very good thing. And we might even invoke the Rambam's insistence on the centrality of mystery precisely to use him in a way he would not have loved, or at least he would not have loved when he wrote the Perush HaMishnayot, when he wrote his Mishnah commentary, which is a mystery on some level leads to some degree of doubt. This is a sentence he would have found appalling, just to make that clear. But I think it's actually important to think about. Now, just to say this even more dramatically, not only is it not a bad thing that the proofs of God don't work, it actually is a prerequisite for authentic faith that they fail. Had the medieval succeeded in proving the existence of God, Kierkegaard essentially tells us, they would have destroyed the very possibility of a belief or of a faith commitment, because there would have been no risk involved. I might be wrong. I might be an idiot. There's a tremendous amount of evil and suffering in the world that is impossible to reconcile with a perfect good God. I might be an idiot. And yet I believe I have reasons to believe, and I take a risk. Now, it may be, some will want to say, that there are other kinds of faith too. And Kierkegaard himself, and this gets into a complicated question about Kierkegaard scholarship that I don't want to get into, about different pseudonyms of Kierkegaard. But the book Fear and Trembling is all about the definition of Abraham's faith as the fact that he's completely certain and brooks no doubt. And Abraham in that book is a total hero for that. So the Kierkegaard of the concluding unscientific postscript and the Kierkegaard of Fear and Trembling construct two very different ways of imagining what a faith commitment might be. Is it the total elimination of doubt? I am certain that there is a God and that I can do his will. Or is it, I am not certain, and that very uncertainty is what makes faith possible. And by the way, I would suggest that many 20th century Jewish thinkers, the place where their theology becomes weakest and most shrill is when they insist that certainty is in fact possible. If you read book one of Heschel's God in Search of Man, right, the passages that ring most bullying are the ones when he's trying to insist that he is certain, as opposed to that he has profound faith. In other words, for Kierkegaard, I believe despite, but more importantly, because of not knowing. Now, just, I want to say one last thing about how we should use this. I do not think we should embrace, nor, by the way, does Kierkegaard embrace this, what I'll call, in philosophies, crude volitionalism, by which I say, whether or not I believe is a decision. effective now, I believe in God, and I stake my entire life on taking that risk, right? That is, let's just say, psychologically less than plausible, right? And also simple-minded and in a way simple-hearted, right? If faith, in Kierkegaard's language, is a passion, and passions are things that have to be slowly cultivated, then faith is a project rather than a once-and-for-all decision. Or in language common to the existentialist tradition, faith is the task of a lifetime. But, and here's where the Jewish piece of this is very important, even if I can't simply will myself to believe, I can still will myself to strive to believe. And I can act in ways that make faith possible and even likely. And this notion is all over the rabbinic tradition and is especially clear in a variety of medieval Jewish texts. Perhaps the most influential line is in Sefer HaChinuch, a medieval list of the mitzvot that says, Acharei ha'pu'ulot nimshachim halvavot, that the heart is pulled by actions that I undertake. Or, if you prefer more traditional language, na'aseh v'nishma, and not nishma v'na'aseh. Right? In other words, I will do and then hear, rather than merely hear and then do. In other words, real deep faith can never be accomplished by fiat or by simple decision, but it can be undertaken as a life's project. And I'll suggest, and if I had time I would flesh these out, that some of the attributes that are necessary to make authentic faith possible, I have five here that I think are interwoven, and maybe I'll have time later to talk about that or not. Wonder, humility, gratitude, receptivity, and a willingness to be unsettled. I'll say that one more time. Wonder, humility, gratitude, receptivity, and a willingness to be unsettled. Without those, I don't think faith as a real existential posture is actually possible. Now, I want to say one final thing, and then realize that I will not get to the last part about what does a life of faith look like until next week. Faith as an existential posture or orientation is not, or not primarily anyway, about trust that God will do X or Y for me, or that providence will save me from life's difficulties. Here I'll say, perhaps ironically, I don't believe that any more than the Rambam did. And many of us have seen way too much in our life and the life of our family, people, world, to affirm a simple notion of faith equaling trust and trust equaling God's going to do what I want. For me, anyway, in those rare moments when I think I might come close to having faith, it's a posture not about expectation, but about commitment. And that, for me, is the journey of going from, in my case anyway, the faith of a child to the faith of an adult, is the understanding that it's not about promises God makes for what God will do. The Rambam famously, I forget exactly now where this is, says, you know, we say that because simple people need to believe that, but of course the world is more complex than that. It's actually instead about my commitment to God and my aspiration to place God and God's will at the very center of my life. It is, in other words, an aspiration to self-transcendence. It's an aspiration to put something other than my own wants and needs at the center of my world, and ultimately at the center of the world. The last thing, in source five, I'm sorry, in part five on your sheet, I just want to point out that a text that supports this reading, although I am self-consciously and in full disclosure taking one paragraph from a much larger argument and using it as a support for what I'm suggesting, trust. Bitachon means, to me anyway. I'm reading now from a passage in a medieval devotional book called Kad HaKemach, and I was led to this passage by an essay by Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, who would have some misgivings about how I'm going to use it, but it's okay. Va'od me'inyan ha'bitachon, she'yimsor adam nafsho el Hashem yitbarach. Now, I'm going to translate this idiomatically in a minute, but he says, another aspect of bitachon, this in other words is in the context of a long discussion of bitachon, trust as trust that in the more conventional sense. But he adds this dimension. Bitachon is, she'yimsor adam nafsho el Hashem yitbarach, that is, that a person will dedicate his soul to God. V'tiyei machshavto shotetet tamid bidvar ze. And his every thought should be preoccupied with this. Ilu hayu ba'im lehorgo, o she'avor al ha'torah, she'he moser atzmo al hamita v'lo ya'avor. Bitachon is the belief that were they to come to martyr me, unless I violated the Torah, I would be willing to be martyred. Just bear with me for a minute. Ve'alze amar David alav shalom, and this is what David meant when he said, Eilecha Hashem nafshi esa. This is what David meant when he said, I will dedicate my soul to you, O God. I'm just skipping the second part of the pasuk. Ki hamoser hanefesh b'inyan ze hu me'inyan habitachon. Because the dedication of one's soul is an aspect of bitachon. Now, I'm not sure we should say that that's all trust is. But I will say that I think in the 21st century, that's the heart of what trust is. And it actually doesn't really work in English. The heart of bitachon, I think this is what's implicit here, ironically, is trust in myself that I am completely dedicated to God. That on some level, bitachon is a kind of, or an aspiration to self-trust that God is what matters. Now, we, many of us, have, especially understandably in our political context, all kinds of nervousness of language of martyrdom. So I want to just say this in a slightly different way. It is me'inyan ha-bitachon. It is a crucial part of bitachon to totally know that come what may, I have committed my life, and if necessary, my death, to God and the values that God holds dear. That's actually the aspiration. And here is the interesting thing. In the history of Judaism, almost everyone eventually says, you know, the heart of entering a relationship with God is almenat. Well, there's two versions of this Mishnah. Shelo almenat lekabel pras, not in order to be rewarded, or in some manuscripts, almenat shelo lekabel pras, in order not to receive a reward, which is really interesting what that means. The Rambam talks about the culmination of tshuva being never having a second thought about what God will do for me, but only totally committing to the good because it's good and to God because God's God. My suggestion is that at our late date in modernity, we have another unique spiritual opportunity. Not just to have real faith because uncertainty is unavoidable, but to have real dedication and avodah lishma, and actually service of God for its own sake, precisely because I'm not sure we have any other alternative. Thank you very much. Ben, you asked the last question first question last time, right? Okay, go for it.
So I'm going to translate it very carefully. So you talked last time about how Rambam says we can't really say anything positive about God. So in essence, God is this other being that we, like, God is not a big man, so we don't really, we can't really, like, it's very difficult in that context.
So there is one question that more than any other in the history of Judaism can never be answered, which was, what did the Rambam really think? No, I mean, seriously, I'm not saying, because in other words, the Rambam does an extremely skilled job of not making it obvious what he's thinking. I do not really understand why the Rambam never understood the potentially deleterious consequences of trying to establish a dogma that was true for now and all time. And further, there are certain things on that list that it seems clear to me the Rambam didn't believe, let's say, in anything remotely approaching a literal way. So the answer to your question is, I don't know, nor does anybody else. Meaning, there is a small amount, not a huge amount, of scholarship sort of speculating about what this list was all about. Some wanting to emphasize that he did that when he was very young. But on the other hand, he lists a lot of those things in more subtle ways in the beginning of Mishneh Torah as well. So the answer is, this is a rambling way of saying, I'm not sure. The reason why I'm skeptical about that is, if you want to take your logic seriously, then a series of belief that claims is also not unproblematic. Unless I believe that I can know nothing at all about God is your first dogma, which, by the way, in some ways would be more consistent with the Rambam of the Guide and of part one of the Mishneh Torah. So I don't know. I don't think that that's all that compelling, but I don't know what to replace it with. And I take comfort in the fact that nor does anybody else really who works on the Rambam. You know, it's an irony, right? The Rambam says at the beginning of the guide that he will talk in a way, one of the reasons he will talk in an elusive way is that it's important to hide your view from those who are not ready for it. Well, the Rambam, I mean, ironically ended up perhaps being more skilled at that than he perhaps intended. And the history of Rambam scholarship from the people who wrote on him while he was alive till half of the philosophy department at the Hebrew University today are still fundamentally arguing about each theological category in the Rambam and what it is was the real opinion. By the way, it's interesting. In our own little postmodern time, there's a new thing emerging in the last 25 years, although I don't think anyone has noticed it as a large phenomenon, which is that all of a sudden, people are arguing about different parts of the guide that the real secret of the guide is that the Rambam couldn't make up his mind. That he wasn't sure. He was sort of going to make the best arguments he could and then leave it to be. Now, that, by the way, is a very interesting reading of the guide. The only reason I'm suspicious of it is I'm always nervous when figures from different periods and times begin to look exactly like we wish they would, right? meaning the Rambam starts to sound like in a kind of epistemological postmodernism. Yeah, I don't know this, I don't know that, I don't know this. It's only a statement of where I live that I find that to be a very interesting reading of the Rambam. But I also want to be suspicious out of self-awareness that that may say more about us and what my late teacher Isidore Twersky called the self-mirroring of all Maimonides scholars, right? We all paint a Rambam who looks like us. Rambam would have been the founding Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Hadar. Lahavdil, elef umilyonei havdalot. Yes. Other comments or questions? Yeah, John. I mean, I don't know. I feel like I have that conversation with people in my life not so infrequently. I mean, that may say something about my own illness. But no, I mean, meaning I think that's a conversation that people have in lots of ways, which is anyone who is not certain, anyone who is not, let's say, I mean, I'm trying to think of an example of someone who knows that there is a God. Anyone who is not the Rosh Yeshiva of Esh HaTorah running the discovery program, and on the other hand, anyone who is not Richard Dawkins, right? Anyone who is not absolutely certain of their position, they know the truth. Kant be damned. Modern philosophy be damned. We know the truth, right? We found Bible codes. We know the truth, right? If you move those people out of the conversation, everybody else is in some version of that conversation, or at least those who are willing to be honest about the complexity of the situation they find themselves in. So yeah, totally. Now, I still think, and here's again why I don't want to have that Kierkegaardian reading where it's a kind of random choice. I think we all, here I am something of a Maimonidean, meaning I think we should all be thinking about why and why not we might believe in God, but I don't think all those reasons have to be rational and philosophical. But we're all in the same boat of living in a world where we don't know if life is meaningful, let alone if there's a personal God who brought the world into being. We don't know. By the way, Richard Dawkins and Noach Weinberg are in the same boat as I am. They just won't admit it. It's what it means to be modern. Maybe what it means to be human. Have I not understood your question?
You probably understood my question as I posed it, but
you know that John has been spending his whole day learning Gemara, right? I now realize that there's a different question I was asking. Yeah, go for it. Okay, you'll ask me later.
Yeah. And the response with the lack of faith.
Yeah.
There must be a very significant, important, major, earth-shattering difference.
Yes, so I hope...
So I'm asking you not to imagine the conversation, I'm asking you to articulate the difference.
Okay, so come back next week. Okay. No, meaning, I mean... Okay, John Lopatin has just asked me to describe the difference between Heschel and Camus in one sentence, right? Two people who live with uncertainty... No, so look... Here's one thing I would say, and at the risk of saying something that I'm not sure I will believe 2 hours from now, but I think that there is a way in which those who are really passionately, and I use that word consciously, passionately concerned about these questions have more in common than they do with those who are not passionately concerned about these questions because they already know the answers. And in that sense, Camus has a lot in common with a religious believer. Now, I think the life that you perceive and understand becomes different. Let me give you an example, okay? Here's an example, which is, I think if you built a theology out of this story, it would be problematic, but I think it's a very important corrective. There is a very sort of interesting story about the Kutzker. There actually are no uninteresting stories about the Kutzker. But one of the stories about the Kutzker is that a student approaches the Kutzker Rebbe and says, Rebbe, I don't know if there's a God. Right? You know the story? And the Kutzker says, what do you care? And the student says, Rebbe, what do you mean? What do I care? If there's no God, then God didn't probably write the Torah. The Kutzker says, what do you care? The student says, Rebbe, I'm a little lost, right? I mean, if there's no God, and the Torah, so why am I doing mitzvot? God says, what do you care? So he says, Rebbe, I don't understand what you're talking about, right? There's no God, and the Torah is just a book, and mitzvot don't mean anything. What is the meaning of my life? The Kutzker says, you care? Du bist a kosher yid. Right? You care, you're a kosher Jew. Now, again, I don't think you should build a whole worldview out of that, but I think there's something extremely profound in that story, which is that part of faith is actually profoundly caring about the question. It's profoundly caring about the question. And that student, at least on one level, lived a life of profound faith, even though other voices in my head can critique that position very easily. But I think there's something very deep about that story, and we'll leave it at that for now. Eugene.
I have an open question. This is not a hostile question, but
never believe a guy who says that. Yeah, go ahead.
You define Emunah as trust in God. kind of deconstruct or even debunk the notion that God is one who rewards and punishment and punishes.
Now, in the Bible, in a way that I can.
But in the Bible, that's clearly what they meant: trust in God. I mean, if you read Tehillim and they're really talking about God repaying your actions with good. And that's the nature of trust. But if we sophisticated moderns don't hold to that anymore, that God, you know, rewards and punishes, and we don't hold to what the medievalists maintain, which is namely that belief and trust was in cognitive truth out there. So what does it really mean to say, in what sense is God trustworthy, and what do you entrust to him? What do you expect from him? What's the nature of this trust?
Well, okay, so...
In other words, what is modern faith?
Thank you, Eugene, for exposing the ultimate question of my life. No, look, that's why I ended the way I did by talking about this Kat HaKemach piece of Bitachon. So I want to be more explicit about the ways in which what I'm saying is, I hope, continuous with, but also the ways that it might be discontinuous with biblical and rabbinic faith. The continuity is about the realization that faith is fundamentally an existential posture and a life orientation. The discontinuity is that I think that in our time, and I believe that the Gemara in Shabbat that I read allows us to move in this direction, faith as an existential posture or a life orientation becomes about commitment to rather than expectation of. Now, right, that's the transformation. It becomes, that's what I meant by saying, life is lishma or else. Because there's no other alternative. I'm not closed to the possibility that I will be severely punished in the next world. And I mean that seriously. Meaning I'm open on that question. But my point is, when I live in this world, I have no choice. If shelo lishma means I'm going to be punished if I go astray, I cannot bring myself to that belief. So I'm suggesting that, ironically, that creates the possibility of an even more mature faith. And I don't mean to suggest that biblical faith is immature. I mean to suggest that the covenant evolves over time. As lots of thinkers have thought, and so what it means to commit to living with God is to commit my life to the author of this world and my life within it, to the one who is the source of goodness and the possibility of love and transformation, and to say, that's who I want to love. That's where I want to stake my life. There are forces of oppression and degradation and horror in the world, and I choose to commit myself to the one who brought the world into being and reveal Torah as a manifestation of God's profound love for the Jewish people and the world, without expectation of really much of anything in return, because I've already received the most enormous gift possible, which is my life, which I did not earn. And there, as I'll talk about sometime, a little bit next time, that I think is basically the Rambam on some level too, right? That faith emerges precisely from the sense that my existence and the existence of the world are pure, unmitigated gift, or, to use other language, grace. And so I commit myself to the one who created this magnificent thing called life and consciousness. In other words, right, the 10th chapter of Hilchot Tshuva is all we got. Please. Oh, no. Yeah. Okay. Bring it on. Yeah.
Well, I just think that as interesting and fascinating and learned as this discussion is, that they have a better philosophical position than you do, which is that there are an infinite number of possibilities for the existence of the world and the way things are. And yours is one of them. The history of the people who believe in it all, in a single being that's being responsible for it, is one of them. But there are an infinite number of other ones that are logically just as plausible. And their therefore, it's rather ridiculous, except in the context of faith, which takes you out of the context of philosophy, to live your life as if yours is the truth.
Okay, so, gosh.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is I'm curious as to what you meant by they agree with you, because in other words, you're saying they have the same problem that you do.
Dawkins
and Dennett.
No, all I meant by that is, epistemologically, whether or not they want to admit it, they know less about metaphysics than they think they do. Now, I don't really want to get into this with 1 minute to go. I will say this. There is one sentence that I cannot, I say this with affection, tolerate, right? Richard Dawkins is not a more sophisticated philosophical thinker than anyone, including most high school students. He may be a phenomenal explainer of science, but all you have to do is read The God Delusion and have taken a single course in medieval philosophy to understand this person has no conception of what any of the arguments in medieval philosophy are about, has no understanding of what divine simplicity has meant in the philosophical tradition. I mean, that book is, when it comes to philosophy, an embarrassment. As I think almost any philosopher you'll ask, except for A.C. Grayling, would admit. That's because he's an even more embarrassing philosopher than Dawkins. So it seems to me that there is a question that Dawkins actually cannot answer. It's a question that Bertrand Russell insisted was incoherent, and yet has been extremely important in the history of philosophy and theology and faith, which is why is there something rather than nothing? I do not believe, from reading the New Atheists fairly seriously, that they have anything remotely interesting to say about that question. And by the way, John, I would say, like, the difference between Dawkins and Camus is that there's profound care and struggle in Camus, and Dawkins is the atheism of an utterly self-satisfied, upper-middle-class British, you know, it's just totally frivolous atheism to me. If we want to wrestle with atheists, let's do it. Let's all read Camus together.
I'm asking a real question.
I'm responding to a real question.
Philosophically speaking, why is the position that there is a God stronger than the one that there is?
So now you're asking the question that I didn't want to try and talk about tonight, which was why believe as opposed to what belief might look like. It's 8:59 and a half. So
you can hold on. I'll be here next week.
I don't know how many theists or atheists ultimately base that decision on an argument in a philosophy seminar. And in fact, I think one of the things that's happened in philosophy since essentially the death of foundationalism is it's not really clear where I should start. It might even be the case that I can begin from an experience of God as the fundamental place from which my philosophy begins. That's first of all, okay? So I'm not sure that even philosophically that question actually makes all that much sense anymore. No one starts from nowhere, including Richard Dawkins. But if you're asking a question of me, is my belief in God ultimately derivative of my reading of philosophy? No. I spend an awful lot of time, like many theists, thinking philosophically about the implications and possibilities of my faith and constantly critiquing it in light of what I learned from philosophy. But ultimately, my faith in God, which I think is true about most believers, derives from an intuition, not an argument. By the way, this is where Heschel goes most wrong. He did not understand the difference between an intuition he had and an argument he had made. He simply did not understand the difference. That's where Book 1 of God in Search of Man, for all its genius, falls apart. But that's not something I'm embarrassed about. I think the most important decisions we make in life are based on intuitions. I didn't decide to marry my wife based on an argument. Honest to God.
The arguments came after.
And I know that my wife didn't... No, that's true. And I can guarantee you my wife didn't choose me based on an argument. Right? The point is, I think ultimately the fundamental life orientation we choose is about an intuition. And one of the places that wonder leads me is to the sense that there is someone who brought this world into being. I don't know who that someone is. It's very limited what I can say about that someone, but that's my fundamental intuition about the world. For someone who wants to be philosophically argued into belief in God, I would say it's really sad, but you live after Kant. I can't do it. You live after Kant, right? You simply cannot access rationally that which is totally divorced from what you can experience and cognize. You can't do it. Is that a reason to be an atheist? No, I think for me, it's a reason to discover faith. Now, that said, if I take that position seriously, I cannot go to someone and say, every atheism is morally and theologically culpable, right? It's a failure not to believe. I think God has created a world in which there are many good and plausible reasons not to believe. There may even be good reasons to be a nihilist. There may be. So all I can do as a believer is live a life in such a way that reflects what I understand it means to believe in God and articulate for those who are interested what it looks like on the inside to be a believer. Anything else is arrogance and presumption and doesn't acknowledge where we live in the history of ideas. Right? I can't do that. All I can do is manifest and describe. I can't argue. I can argue against bad arguments against, but I can't argue. And Kierkegaard's point, and you know, ultimately mine, is that's actually what makes a life of faith possible, even if it makes cognitive certainty permanently elusive. All right. I think one last question, and then we'll end, because I know it's... Please. Okay, so I'm going to have to deflect the Levinas piece because it's 9:03 and it's a huge conversation, and we would then have to begin to talk about whether Levinas uses the language of God in anything but purely metaphorical ways. Which I suspect the answer is no, and God is many things, but in my worldview, not a metaphor. Relationship means that we are on a path together rather than in a fully realized, permanent state of stasis. My relationship with God is no more static and unmoving than my relationship with any human being I care about, and in some ways, less so. Because if I believe in God as an other with whom I can interact, then who I am as a human being today is not the same as who I am as a human being tomorrow or 3 days ago, which means that faith is inherently dynamic and in motion. Which is one of the reasons I'm always so nervous about publishing anything about what I think about God. And I'm actually not being told, I'm actually being kind of serious, because 2 weeks later it's like, oh, I'm not really sure that I would defend that anymore. But okay, if all I'm doing is describing... By the way, this is one of the reasons I think that Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik in his philosophical essays basically did what I would call, to coin a completely unhelpful term, autophenomenology. What he did was, no, I'm being totally serious, what he did was describe what faith looked like to him at a particular moment in time. Right? And different essays have different theologies and worldviews. Right? If you want to drive yourself insane, try to create a synthesis of all of Soloveitchik's essays and derive a coherent worldview about faith and theology. You will not succeed, I suggest. Right? You will not succeed. Right? And I think one of the reasons for that, one of the profound lessons of that, is that a relationship can only be captured in terms of snapshots in time, not in terms of eternal truth. Or, to use the language of the existentialist tradition, eternal truths are not about existing beings. They are about eternity, not about people who live in time. And we are people who live in time, and the paradox of a life of faith is that we live in time with the one who is eternal. But that means that although God may not change, I do, and therefore the dynamic between us does. And I think that's already laid out in various biblical texts, right? Abraham's relationship with God changes in almost every chapter of the system of Abraham stories, the cycle of Abraham stories. So I don't know if I've really answered your question, but I think what relationship means is precisely that there's no checklist. And a checklist of cognitive claims is not a relationship. There's actually nothing ventured in affirming a list of cognitive claims. There's everything ventured in saying, I choose to live my life with you. That's what it begins to mean to have faith. I'll try to talk next week much more about what I think a life of faith might look like. But I would maybe end by saying it's the task, it is again the task of a lifetime, meaning it is an eternally moving relationship in which I aspire to embody more and more deeply the values and ideals that I think God most cherishes. And I fail and I keep trying. That's the project of a life, as Judaism imagines it. I fail and I keep trying, and I believe that God is endlessly forgiving for those who actually commit themselves to trying to live better and deeper with God. Okay, thank you.